Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. That was Life in the Fast Lane from the Eagles, cracking tune, I think, off Hotel California. Before that, the Fink Brothers, Mutants in Mega City 1, back in the Houses of Parliament, I gather. And we kicked off with Ted Nugent and Motor City Madhouse. Nice quick bit of hard rock there. Well, we're joined on the line tonight by Chris Evans from the Himalayan Permaculture Centre. I see he's joined us in the chat box here at the radio as well. Thanks very much for being there, Chris, and thanks for joining us on People's Internet Radio. You're very welcome, sir.
Welcome, and thanks for inviting me.
It's a real pleasure. So, you've been at the permaculture thing for really quite some time now. You've obviously got a lot of experience. I'm very much looking forward to talking to you about what you've been doing. I guess it'd be good to start off perhaps with a bit of a definition of what permaculture is and why it's important.
That's always an interesting question to answer, because there are many definitions. People often, you know, make up their own, and that's fine. So start with the shortest and easiest, which my partner Luby said the other day, is it's a way of thinking differently. Simply, it can be simple as that. Another good friend had the one that it's a revolution dressed up as gardening.
I like that.
And what's interesting about that is that a lot of people's perception of permaculture is that it's just about gardening or growing food. And as you might know, you know, it goes a lot broader than that. But there it is. It's a revolution dressed up as gardening. And a slightly more complex or long-winded version is that it's the application of the principles of ecology in the design of sustainable human habitats, which is, yeah, long-winded, but it's actually, it says a lot in relatively few words.
They're fairly carefully chosen words, I think, those, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, each one has a story. So design and, you know, sustainable human habitats, principles of ecology, they've all got their own sort of whole sessions behind them, but it does sum it up. In terms of why we need to do it, then that's also, you know, it could be a long story, but basically I think we all realise the problems that we're facing on many levels, social, economic, ecologic, all of these are things that we can actually solve. And, you know, it's in our hands to do that if we understand where the problems have come from, why they're there, why they're persisting or getting worse, and understanding then how we can, you know, approach solving them. So to me, what permaculture gives a roadmap of being able to do that. It's not, you know, it's not an end in itself. It's a way of being able to live in a more sort of sustainable, abundant world, and not degrading or destroying the resources that we need to do that.
Yes, as much as anything, it's a matter of building on the resources we've got and actually kind of actually working them to be more useful to us and making them more long-lived and more productive, isn't it? Without wasting materials.
Exactly, yeah, and we've got the technologies to do that. We've got all the techniques. I mean, I think what's good about permaculture is that it is a synthesis of lots of different things. It takes lessons from nature, because if humans weren't here, nature would be, you know, doing what it is, and it wouldn't be wrecking itself. It would be actually coexisting with all in all its parts. And it's people that have come along and sort of impacted on that in largely a negative way. The instances where people haven't impacted on nature are sort of indigenous cultures, hunter-gatherers, forest dwellers, not just, but, you know, that those sort of communities or societies have learned to live within their limits and to actually take care of the resources that they're or the environment that they're part of. And so permaculture takes a lot of lessons from that as well, from how communities lived with their within limits with their local resources in a sort of regenerative way. But it also takes its lessons or examples from modern science and technology. So, you know, ways of assessing soil nutrients, ways of applying soil nutrients, for example, you know, appropriate technology, ways of harnessing solar power or other earth energies, the whole lot, you know, whether it could be psychology, it could be physiology, it could be medicine, it could be education, whatever, we've actually used these great sort of powers that we have in very positive ways as well as very negative ways. And so I think permaculture also uses the positive of the modern advances that we've made as well. So it's not like throwing the baby out with the bathwater, or a lot of people say, oh, that's going back to living in the jungles and that sort of thing. But it's not. It's going forward to a more regenerative and sustainable future where we basically take responsibility for ourselves, our you know, human society, and the environment that we need to live in.
And in that sense, in the sense that it's making use of the best of everything we're generating as we move forward, it's really as much to do with culture as a whole as with gardening, isn't it?
Very much. I mean, I think when the founders, Bill Mollis and David Holmgren, when they were developing the concepts back in the early 70s, they were thinking primarily of farming, of agriculture, of food growing. But it was later on that they saw that actually the principles of ecology, or by the principles by which nature sort of is self-sustaining and forever abundant, can be applied to social and economic systems as well. So it does go beyond food production. I suppose what we all have in common is that we all need to eat, and you know, that is what sustains us. But there are other things that sustain us as well: our work, our friends, our family, you know, our environment. And so we need a way of improving or making those resilient from you know, damage or bad influence as well, and so that's where permaculture has been applied quite extensively now in urban settings, to education, to health and medicine, to business. Yeah, the list goes on.
That's interesting, isn't it? So in a way, the actual development of permaculture itself is kind of echoing what permaculture is trying to achieve, in that when it started, it was simply a matter of growing food, and then people noticed that a bit of other stuff could be useful, so they added it to the mix. And I guess when we say that it's a way of thinking differently, it's starting to think at all is the first step, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, recognizing that we need to change. That, you know, what we're doing isn't right, and then seeking how to do that. Yeah,
and it all starts with design, really, doesn't it? It starts with how you're going to get the best out of the piece of land that you're looking at, and how it possibly is going to get the best out of you. Where do we start with that?
Well, that's an interesting question. How do you actually use it? And you know, it's sometimes it can be simpler than it seems. So with design, it starts with observation. A lot of people, we have this tendency to jump in and say, right, I'm going to do this, that, and the other, put this there, and build that, and dig there, or whatever. And without sort of observing and reflecting on that observation. And I say more and more now, I think more and more, that the observation is actually, we should spend more time doing that than the activities that come afterwards. So the first thing to do then with whether it's a garden or whatever system it is you want to design, And let's remember that people are always designing. You know, when you arrange your furniture, you're designing. When you're cooking a meal, it's like you're designing things to go together. So it's not an alien thing for us to be doing at all. But the first stage is to observe where you are, the place that you're in, that you want to work with, and just observe. So it's a nice expression is don't just do something, stand there. So, you know, it takes that familiar expression and turns it on its head and just observe. Be like a camera that doesn't make judgment. It doesn't anticipate or assess anything. It just takes a picture. That's all it does. And so just observing, if it's say your garden, yeah. So you observe things like temperature, like wind, sunlight, shade areas. You might be observing the birds or the wildlife or your cat, where it likes to go and sit in the sun. And, you know, really get to know the place. And, rule of thumb is that to do a design on a place, you need to observe it for four seasons. So throughout a year, the whole year, because then you get to see how it changes over the year. Obviously in our climate, you know, there is quite big seasonal changes. So it's, yeah, observe, but not only observe the land, observe yourself. Or other people that are involved in that land. So that's where you need to be clear on what you want. So what's your vision, or your goals? What are your constraints? What are your resources? That sort of thing. So it's observing the two things. One is the land that you're designing, and one is yourself as the person that's going to be there. If you're designing for someone else, then they're a kind of client, and they're telling you what they want. And then you go on from there, and then you see, you sort of extrapolate from that vision, from what you want and from what the land is telling you it wants in that sense, what functions you need on the site. What does it need to do in order to, achieve those aims?
I guess that what you actually want and what you think you might do with the place probably changes as you take that year or so looking at it, doesn't it? Because we quite often approach a project with preconceptions, and they could change quite substantially over a 12-month period.
Very much. As you see things change, you know, from dry to wet, from hot, from cool to warm. It's not quite to say hot. It doesn't get that hot here much. But, things change, and designing for flexibility is another aspect of it. So you need to design to be able to change if you need or want to. And like I say, preconceptions. I mean, I'm always having to sort of remind myself, if I'm looking at a piece of land, that I don't want to design it. I'm not thinking of what I'd like to do. I could put a pond there or a shelter belt there, or, you know, that would look really nice with fruit trees or a trellis or something. But when I'm first going to a land, then it's just watch, just observe, just feel, and learn what's there. And it's interesting because I find that approach also applies to meeting people as well. When I'm introduced to someone, or I meet someone, even if I know them, I want to tell them something, or I want to do something with them. And I find that the same thought occurs to me, which is interesting, and that is, okay, let's just listen to what they've got to say. How are they? What's their body movements? That sort of thing. It's an interesting pattern of behaviour.
So permaculture has kind of changed the way you think and approach people as well in the time you've been using it.
Yeah, very much. As well as being a sort of interacting tool, because I've done a lot of teaching and facilitation with permaculture. It's a great learning tool as well, not only of the land, but of, yeah, people and communities. So it's a multifunctional tool, if you like.
I think another thing about the observe and interact principle is that in the long run, you can save yourself an enormous amount of time, energy, resource, and mistakes by taking that kind of approach. It means by thinking, working it through in your mind, doing what Einstein might have called a mind experiment on it, you can make sure you're more likely to get it right first time. And I guess approaching the situation gradually probably also adds to that advantage.
Definitely. I mean, we say in design that you know, if you put 80% of your time and energy into the thinking, and I'd include in that the observation, then it means you only need to put 20% into the implementation or the maintenance of the system. So observation rich approach, I think, is generally a good idea. And you're right. One of the effects of that is that it'll save time. It'll reduce mistakes. So it might, you know, if it could save time or money, it could save plants. You know, if I plant something in the wrong place, even though I thought it was in the right place when I planted it, then when the time comes and you realize that it's too wet, the roots are rotting, it's gone. So you've wasted time, you've wasted money, you've wasted the plant as well. So, it pays, I think, to spend, you know, that extra time, not doing, but watching.
Do you find that, to a certain extent, having a limited resource actually helps this process? Because one of my experiences of gardening with and for other people has been that those who have a lot of money and a lot of resource and not necessarily a lot of experience tend to do things very quickly and in a fairly expensive fashion, and they live fairly quickly to regret that sort of thing. And I think the most successful projects I've been involved in have been with people who've got a very limited resource, and so I guess in a way they're kind of forced to think pretty carefully about what it is they're going to do and how they're going to commit that resource to the ground.
Yeah, and they're also going to emphasize, you know, recycling, reusing, and, you know, all the things that kind of make sense anyway. You know, wild foraging, patting and checking out skips and that sort of thing, which, you know, is a useful thing to do because it keeps stuff out of landfill. So, but I think you're right. And interestingly, you know, in the two-thirds world where people don't have access to a lot of resources anyway, they've still got, those characteristics of using local resources and using human resources more as well. So, you know, the linkages and between people in society that we seem to not actually do much of over here. Now we've got all, you know, our tablets and our phones and all this sort of thing. So they're actually using social links much more than other physical resources as well.
Do you find when you're introducing the permacultural projects that kind of social thing expands, because community is something I think that we're sadly lacking nowadays? And it's again been my impression that when you're dealing with plants and the landscape, people are far more likely to come together, cooperate, share their knowledge. Has that been your feeling?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it does connect a lot of people. And it connects people in a sort of easy, non-threatening way, is working with the land and with the plants. And they say, that there's a chemical, is it a hormone or something in the soil, that it's actually responsible for a feel good factor. So this is actually an actual sort of physical, presence in the soil. It's not an abstract thing. It's a chemical that's in the soil that, you know, and it's one of the reasons why, you have this thing about therapeutic gardening, that you can actually use gardening as therapy, for you know, people with troubles of various types. And so, yeah, working with the land does bring people together, I think, and it's easy to do it by yourself as well. I mean, you're talking about, you know, people with lots of money often wasting it and people with less money doing better, or more sensible design. Actually, I'd quite like to have a lot of money and I could do some good designs with that. I do feel now, if people gave me a few million, I think I'd know where to put it.
That's kind of with that's with the benefit of 30 or so years experience, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I would have obviously done something different 30 years ago than I'd be doing now if someone gave me $1 million.
Yes, hopefully we'll get to explore a bit later in the show the wide range of things that you've managed to develop for people. I think another important point that might commonly be missed certainly in the Western world is how much easier it is to get to know people and get to like them if you're actually working with them and doing something useful with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's satisfaction, isn't it? And that is one of our many needs. I mean, we have some very basic needs like food and shelter and, you know, clothing and that sort of thing. But there are many other needs as well, like the satisfaction of a good job, that you're doing something useful, that you're interacting with other people. They all sort of combine to make up a well-being, I suppose.
Yeah. So once you've finished observing and interacting, what tend to be the first things that you approach on a piece of land?
Well, I'll say then after the observation, what you need to do is kind of extract the functions that you need the site to do. So it might be grow food, it might be shelter from the wind, it might be shade from the sun or let the sun in. It might be to protect the soil or stop soil erosion. It could be to generate income. It could be to foster wildlife or attract wildlife. So there's all lots of different functions that you will want the site to do. All functions that the site says it needs. So that might be sort of preventing soil erosion or something like that. And so that's the next phase then is talking about functions. The next phase after that then is saying, okay, well, what systems do I need that will perform those functions? So if I want, if I need a shelter belt or if I need wind protection, then I need a shelter belt. And for a shelter belt, I can use, a tree system or an agroforestry system. A hedge, for example, just a simple hedge, something we all know. And so there, what I've now got is a system. So that's what I've ended up at, in that phase, is I've got a system, that fulfills the function, that I've identified from the observation. So if you follow the pathway.
Yeah.
So it's the observation that leads to the functions, that leads to the systems. What I need to do then is place that system in the right place where it will do that function. So if I put my shelter belt on the north side of my land and the wind's coming from the north, it's going to help shelter that. If I put a tree belt on the south side, it's going to shade the land and make it cooler. It's the right system, but it's in the wrong place. So you've got to think about those things. So it's the observation leads to the functions. The functions lead to the systems. The systems that is then placed, which is the actual kind of design, I suppose, the placement of that system in the landscape. And then of course the system, well, it's a system that's made up of lots of different things. So it might have different species of different heights, which have their own functions. Some might be fuel wood, some might be wildlife food, some might be bee forage or whatever. And so I'm also applying the principles in that design to say that, okay, for example, I'm going to make this stacked. So I'm going to do a multi-layered system, make most use of the space, and I'm going to give that system lots of functions. So it's going to be not only a windbreak, which is its primary function, but it's also going to be a bee forage resource. It's going to be a fuel wood system. I could hang more washing on it. You know, you name it, I'll give it more and more functions, and that's making it more productive in terms of the inputs I had to put in to establish it.
Yeah, and I guess some of these things, like a hedge, doesn't take itself too long to establish, whereas a section of trees would take a lot longer to grow. Some of the things you want to do are actually reliant on doing other things first. So I suppose this again brings out the advantage of actually spending a good amount of time looking at it, because it's going to give you a chance to work out what needs to be done first, really.
Yeah, well, that brings us nicely onto the next phase. So once you've looked at your placement and you've got your design, so you've got your garden, you've placed all your elements, pathways, seating areas, pond, you know, shelter belt, beehive, whatever, then you've got your implementation plan. So that's also part of the design, and that tells you what you're going to do next, what's going to happen next week, next month, next year, you know, for as many, as long as you want it. And one of the ways of approaching that is, as you mentioned, you know, the development of one area will assist development of another area. We call that incremental design. There's no point putting in a fruit nursery, for example, until I've got a fence, on our land. This is what we've done, a fence to protect it from deer and rabbits, and B, water to irrigate the plants once they've been grafted. So if I did it the wrong way around, then I'd have lots of grafted trees in my nursery and they'd be getting eaten by deer and dried out in the sun. So I need to do the water and the fencing first before I do anything else. So yeah, that's also sort of common sense, a sequence, if you like. And we call that incremental design, where the establishment of one part of the system then helps the establishment of the rest.
And that again is, that can really help you in your management of resource as the thing is becoming manifest, because it determines what it is that you need to go looking for before you go looking for the next stuff. Once again,
that's right.
There's a tendency, if you've got a lot of resource, to just buy a load of stuff in and then everything's getting in the way of everything else. I think it makes it a lot easier to handle your materials and use them if you're approaching it the way you describe.
Yeah. And I mean, also, it's also capturing the right resources at the right time. And if you're using biological resources, an example, just yesterday, we were at the land and I was thinking, right, we need something now, but we're going to need a lot more later, fertility. We're going to need like compost and mulch material and that sort of thing. So, there's a lot of nettles there, so I've got the scythe out and you know, started madly scything away at nettles, and now what we've got is a huge amount of you know, lots of piles of nettles. Well, if I'd have waited or you know, did that in a different order and done that, you know, a month later, the nettles would have seeded, and they wouldn't have been so full of nutrition for compost. So what I've done is cut them now, and that means that they'll regrow. And so actually in a month they won't have seeded, they'll have regrown and I'll be able to cut them again. And I was thinking about, I was working with a friend and I said, I looked at the pile of nettles the several piles of nettles that we've made at the end, and I said, mate, we've just opened a bank account.
Yeah.
What we've done is opened a bank account and we've got wealth, i.e. nettles, sitting there, you know, in a big pile, and that is our interest.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing we're going to use. We're not going to use the capital. The capital is the nettles that are growing in the soil and they're going to regrow. So, you know, the capital's not harmed, but we've just got the interest there. And that is what we're going to then invest by mulching it and, you know, turning it into fertility. And we'll have even more interest as a result of that. So it's a sort of win-win, ever abundant system. Where your capital is never harmed.
And it's brilliant, isn't it? Because nettles are very fibrous. They make a good long-lasting mulch. They've got good nutrients in them for your compost heap. And they're also a place where lots of things live in this country, aren't they? I gather that butterflies breed amongst nettles. They only feed off the so-called butterfly bush.
Right. Yeah. No, they're a great plant. And they're free, of course.
Yeah, and of course they're regarded by most people as basically a pain in the Harris, and you've just pointed out that they're not. And of course, as Jess, or Synchro as she's known in the chat box, she harvests the seeds and we eat those all year as well. They're apparently very, very good for us.
Right, yeah. Yeah, soup and clothing and you name it, from nettles. They're very, very useful plants. One of our great resources.
Yes, so you wouldn't be getting rid of your nettle patch, you'd be keeping it and using it. And I love the description of it as interest and capital and all of that. It puts it into the kind of terms that really bring that home to people.
Yeah. And one that is nurturing as well. You know, you look after your capital, and the interest looks after itself. And I think that's a very good lesson for humanity, basically.
Yeah.
Think of the water systems, the seas, the soils that are being damaged, you know, sometimes beyond repair, and what a waste that is. And yet we call ourselves, advanced society, and it's like, yeah. I don't know where that comes from.
No, Homo sapiens, sapiens. I think it's a bit cocky myself. Although, you know, as we develop things, as we develop systems like permaculture and start looking at the world in the kind of way you're describing, perhaps eventually we will become Homo sapiens working together. I mean, I'm constantly struck by how incredibly generous nature is. You know, you can, one of the places where we spend a lot of time, there are some very ancient coppice trees. There's coppice beech, coppice lime, and it had never struck me until I saw these things that if you can either cut a tree down at the wrong time of year and kill it, or you can cut it down for fuel at the right time of year and get three or four trees where there was one before, until eventually you end up with the most amazing stand of trees, all of which have come from one original thing. And it seems quite clear to me that using these kind of techniques, the world could be a plentiful place for all of us. There's no need to destroy it in the use of it.
No, I've got another good example of that as well. Another mate, a woodsman down in Sussex, Ben Law, he runs coppice, mainly chestnut coppice, and does a lot of woodworking, a lot of green building as well with that. And he was describing the other day how, I forget what the figure is now. Is it 10 acres for one house? 10 acres of coppice chestnut will build a house, basically. But the point is that when you cut a coppice, so he runs his coppice on 20 to 30 year rotation. So when you cut a coppice, it doesn't die. So you cut a coppice, build a house, and 20 years or 30 years later, you can cut it again and build another house. And so there was something like 12,000 hectares of waste woodland in Sussex in his area. And so, you know, we did a rough calculation, worked out how many houses that would build, not just once, but, you know, 30 years later, it would do the same again. And one stump might last for 300 or 400 years. So how many houses would that build? And yeah, that's actually how houses were built in the olden days, is a lot of it through coppice systems. And you know, it's that sort of care and attention to what we've now taken for granted and think that we need bricks and concrete to do it all. Mm. Where we lost the plot, really.
Yeah, I read a book called The Old Wheelwright Shop, which was about a guy who inherited his father's wheelwright's business in, I think, the 1800s, the 19th century. And they didn't just do wheels, they built whole carts. And they were talking in that about how these people would go through the woods and identify which trees were going to be taken out, and they'd know when they coppiced them just exactly which bit of the cart they were going to be used for, and they'd be taken away and seasoned. They'd all be stored in different ways according to which bit of the cart or wheel they were going to be used for. And these were renewable systems. It also said in there that when they built the Oxford colleges with their banqueting halls and stuff like that, the oak that they cut down to use for the beams, when they built the place, they planted new oaks so that, you know, 100 years or 150 years down the line, there'd be replacement timber. And it's just a completely different world compared with the dreaded concrete and bricks, really.
Right, yeah, long-term thinking.
Yeah.
And all those rural activities as well. I mean, I know on one hand, you know, they didn't have a lot of things. They didn't have certain access to, you know, medical advancements and some sciences and the like as well. But what they did have was all 100% employment. Everyone was working. There wasn't unemployment, you know, in those days. Just take just think of thatching, for example. I mean, you know, all the houses, or not all, but most would have been thatched as opposed to, you know, tiled or concreted. And so the thatching industry was massive. It was, you know, all areas or most areas of the country would have their own area of thatch production. They'd have their, all the, you know, the farmers would know how to thatch as well. And it was all sorted basically. Another friend of a few years back was thatching a place down in Dorset, and they said they had to get their thatch from China. Could you believe it? Because there wasn't any locally. I think eventually, no, they could have got it from Scotland, but it was too expensive or something, so they had to get it from China. Can you believe that? And yet this sort of thing would, you know, it would have been in every county, in every parish. There would have been thatch and thatchers, to do that. Yeah, so we've lost a lot of skills and resources to make life easy for ourselves.
Oh,
basically. We've made it a lot more for ourselves as a result.
Yeah, well, to a great extent, we're actually designing it out of our systems rather than in, aren't we? Because I gather that a lot of the cereal crops now are developed, bred or modified to grow short because they're easier to crop and there's less what would nowadays be called waste. But again, what you're saying is it's not waste, it's a raw material, potentially.
Yes. Yeah.
And of course the people, although they didn't have access to modern medicine and things, they did manage to find a lot of successful healing actually in amongst the nature that they were working amongst.
Yeah, and I mean one of the points anyway, I suppose, is that, you know, we need to take the best of all worlds. We need to take the knowledge that enables us to use natural and local resources better, but we also need to take the knowledge that's come from, you know, scientific rigor and research and that sort of thing, but the useful stuff. And because I mean, you know, in those days life spans were shorter, kids didn't have access to education so much, more women died in childbirth, there were all those things, there was plague and you know, the list goes on, so it wasn't easy. So you know, I would never say that's the sort of life we want. But there are characteristics of that life that we need. And a lot of the rural skills and the social links that we had, are examples of some of the things that we need from the olden days, if you like. Some of the values. You know, a lot of the people today, they say, oh, it wasn't like that in the old days. And when I was a kid, it was different, you know, and that's because values were different in those days. And so there are some value systems that would also be perhaps useful to carry over to future generations or, yeah, emphasize through education or whatever, as well as skills, and knowledge. Yeah. Where have you gone?
Oh, there we go. Sorry about that. I keep sitting on my mute button, which doesn't really help when you're having a conversation with somebody. Can you still hear me all right?
I can hear me.
Yes, I can. Yeah. Some of the things I look especially at the hedgerows we've got nowadays and how they're trimmed at a time of year which makes sure that they don't flower and so they don't bear any fruit. And also there was a whole lot of other materials that we could get from our hedgerows. And none of it is available to us now, even if we wanted to go for it, which I think is a great shame. Again, there would have been I remember going with my parents to kind of harvest elderberries and various things for making wine and what have you. And I've seen those things more or less disappear as a result of modern farming practice of one sort or another. So that even the choice of taking that sort of lifestyle, if you want to, isn't necessarily available anymore, which seems to be a great shame.
It's not as easy as it was in many ways. A lot of places are more restricted. That's right. I mean, just with hedgerow, it's another example of how backwards our thinking has been, even though we regard ourselves as advanced. So, you know, 40 years ago, 30 years ago, farmers were paid to take out hedges. Now they're being paid to put them back. And similarly, you know, 20, 30 years ago, farmers were being paid to straighten up rivers and streams And now they're being paid to bend them again.
And that's a kind of failure. That's a failure to do what you were describing earlier, which is look at the way nature does things and take advantage of it. Because nature very rarely puts, in fact, nature always put curves into watercourses, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it's a totally natural phenomenon, and for good reason. It helps, you know, it helps with flood control. It creates more edge for wildlife and habitat. And there's all sorts of reasons for doing it. Yeah.
So,
it's not benefited farming in the long run to have straighter rivers or fewer hedges. So now it's going all going back again.
I guess it's good that it is going back. I mean, do you think it's a good idea basically to slow down the movement of water over land, therefore, rather than to speed it up and usher it onto somewhere else?
Generally, yeah, yeah. But I mean, the key is the watershed, the headlands. And I think that's where a lot of, flood control needs to be addressed. So if you've got control over the water where it falls, or the rain where it falls, then it's much easier to control it further downstream. Whereas if you wait till, you know, downstream to try and control it, it's a lot more expensive and more likely to fail. So that's fairly common sense stuff.
So I remember seeing the landscape in the United Kingdom described as upside down. They're saying that all the trees are in the valleys when they should be on top of the hills to keep the water there to start with and slow it down at the point of arrival.
Yeah. So it's slowing it down will also enable us to use it more because it stays with us for longer, instead of sort of rushing in one end of the land and out the other. So because water is also a resource and we can recycle it, we can grow things in it, and use it in different ways. And so slowing it down as like you say, nature will do anyway, is a very sensible strategy.
We've got a question in the chat box, a few lines back from Carrot saying, why is a pond really needed aside from keeping bullfrogs happy? I guess there's plenty of reasons for having ponds, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, the bullfrog is, got a lot of need for a pond. There's a lot of other wildlife, that does as well. And so one aspect is that, yes, that wildlife can then, be co-gardeners. with us, and it can help to control pests. So frogs control slugs, for example. Don't tell me there's a gardener that doesn't have problems with slugs. But also ponds are a microclimate, so they're a heat sink, and they will help to protect against frost, or at least maintain a slightly higher temperature. They're a source of irrigation, so watering. They are a reflective surface, so you can actually, if sighting things that require more light on the north side of a water body, a pond or a lake or whatever, can reflect the sunlight off that to give more sunlight. They are a flood control system. Flood control as well as irrigation. Lots of uses of a pond, as well as being just pretty and nice to sit by.
Yeah, it hadn't occurred to me that they were a light source on the northern side, and it certainly hadn't occurred to me that they're a heat sink, but of course they are. That's quite an interesting idea. And I think it's a
way of having more diversity in your land as well, which is good for many reasons.
And that's another thing that we would have found in every village, isn't it? There used to be a village pond, and lots of them have been removed now.
Yeah. It's seen as a health hazard now, aren't they?
Yes.
Fall in.
Yep. Although it strikes me that not many people fall into bodies of water. And again, there's a failure to take responsibility there. In that you're you're blaming accidents on the pond rather than on the people around it, which strikes me as being a bit misplaced and something I see happening quite a lot.
Yes.
So Yeah. Here's one from Jimmy. He's saying, what would be the best way to hold water back on a site with shallow inclines?
With shallow inclines? So the classic, I suppose, permaculture structure for that is called a swale. A swale is basically a ditch that's run on the contour. So there's been a lot of discussion lately about how relevant scales are to the UK. And, you know, I agree with a lot of it. Swales, I remember doing my design course with Mollison, in fact, in New Zealand. And swales are really, really popular over that side. New Zealand, Australia, where he comes from, as water-holding structures. So it's like, if you do a permaculture design, you need to have a swale sort of thing. Or you have to do a mulch bed, or you'd have to not dig, or you need a herb spiral or something like that. There's all these sort of iconic structures that have gone with permaculture education and design. So a swale is a very popular structure for dealing with overland water flow, and it will hold it. Basically, if you imagine you've got a contour ditch and you've got water running over the surface, then it's going to go into that ditch and it's going to soak into the soil instead of running over the surface, which is a great idea. And certainly where you have limited water, you want all of it in the soil and not running over the surface. But the problem is, in this country, we have most of our water in the winter when we haven't got much thing growing. There's more of a dormant season in the winter. So what you could end up doing is just making the soil really, really wet, without it benefiting anything in terms of vegetation. Mm. And that can also result in it warming up slowly in the spring. So you've got low growth. You might have lower growth overall. So a swale is one way of dealing with overland flow of water, which your friend was, questioner was talking about. To me, a really easy way is just having vegetation. So whether it's allowing the grass to grow long or having a contour row of bushes, it could be bushes, it could be trees. So it's using biological systems to do that function of water control rather than a mechanical system, which would be a swale. It's like digging. One of my teachers, Darren Doherty from Australia, he said that dealing with water using swales is a bit like surgery, as opposed to dealing with it by grass management or tree lines, which is more like massage. So one is very gentle and relatively non-invasive. One is a bit more invasive and physically damaging. Yes, you have to dig your swale. It's a structure. So you've got the choice between doing something mechanical that's a scar on the landscape, if you like, or something that is just actually adding biodiversity to the landscape by planting a row of trees on the contour. I wonder if that answers the question.
I think it does. So there's a couple of things there. So we're talking about using either grass or hedges or trees because their roots actually slow down the movement of the water and retain it around them. I really enjoy the idea of working on contours as well. I think people who haven't tried that would be surprised at how sexy things that are done that way can actually look in the landscape.
Yeah, because they follow natural patterns and curves, and it does look very nice.
Yeah, Jimmy says
as well that, as being very functional.
Yes, yeah, both things. It's something I'd like to do more of in the future, is actually working along contours. I saw a garden at a place called, a piece of ground called Plotgate outside Glastonbury last year, where the first thing they did was they kind of put a barrow track in so that people could get in and out on a level, and it's this a really beautiful snaky path that runs right the way across the land, leaving them with kind of high ground to the right and low ground to the left. And then they built they kind of put their vegetable beds along the contours as well, so they were kind of going down into the land, and it all just looked so pleasing. I guess again, because straight lines are really, strictly speaking, associated with humans, aren't they? They're not very often found in nature.
Yeah, no, that's one of the patterns that we have sort of changed and, yeah, straightened it literally. But I mean, the other thing about curves is that, like a curved edge to a water course or a sort of an edge that's going in and out of a pond rather than a square or just a round pond creates more edge. And edges are incredibly productive parts of our system, garden system, woodland system, pond system, whatever. So having more edge gives a lot more habitat, and you know, we designed to maximize edge, so we actually purposefully make things more curvy than you might think perhaps is necessary. But I personally, you know, if I'm designing, then that's, I'll seek to do that because I know it's going to be more productive.
Yes, I'd heard that the edges or spaces between one thing and another are places where the diversity of ecology is actually increased. Is that right? Apparently you get more species of plants and animals in these, I guess you could call them places of transition between one thing and another. Is that right?
So a classic edge, for example, between a woodland and a pasture, what you've got on the edge, you've got species of birds and insects and plants as well that are common to all three. So you've got pasture system on one side, you've got the woodland system on the other, and in the middle you've got the edge system. So you've got three systems, and you've got species that are common to all of those, and some that pass through, you know, going from pasture to wood and wood to pasture. And you know, often they, birds for example, coming in from one to the other will stop at the edge. And one thing a pattern you might notice with a bird is that whenever it stops and perches, it poos. And so what happens is that the edge in that example becomes accumulation of bird poo. And at the same time as that's happening, you've got the wind that's coming. If it's coming off the pasture into the woodland, it's going to stop or be reduced at the edge. And when you reduce or slow down the wind, you reduce its carrying capacity, and it's full of dust and, you know, bacteria and all sorts of crap. And because its carrying capacity is reduced, it drops it at the edge. And so you've got, you know, you've got bird poo, you've got wind detritus, all that stuff that collects at the edge. Then when it rains, it washes it all off the edge onto the floor. And that's why one of the reasons why edges are more fertile, that fertility itself allows, you know, more diversity of species and faster growth. And, you know, the story goes on, and it's ever increasing spiral of abundance, all because it's an edge. And it's like you say, it's a transition between two systems or sometimes more systems. And, you know, we see with estuaries, so the bird life on the edge of an estuary is phenomenal compared with what it is in a more monoculture system. And you know, permaculture is very much about using edge to increase productivity, increase diversity of different parts of the system, different species or whatever.
Very good. Nick Nomick's just put in the chat box, I've just realised that permaculture is living on the edge. I like that.
Yeah.
Nice little pun. Jimmy's come back to the swales again. He said thanks for that question answered, but he's put, is it a good solution on land which floods badly during heavy rain? What possibly not swales for that. What would you do with land that behaves like that?
Land that floods badly. Well, you could use a swale with a slight incline on it. So not so much a swale as a drainage ditch, and that to help carry or divert the water around. I saw actually in the States there was a good video actually on YouTube I was watching a few months ago, where a guy who was on a floodplain that would regularly flood even without catastrophic rainfall, it would regularly flood, and just by planting of his hedgerows and some small earthworks in strategic positions, he was able to, he couldn't stop the flood, but what he could do was deflect the damaging force of it away from his land, and there was no big earth movements going on with that. You know, he didn't need a dig or anything, just shallow swales he was using, and lots of hedgerows, and he was able to deflect away then a regularly flooding large river. So small swales might help as to divert. I mean, you know, he's not going to want to hold water, or he's not going to want to use swales to hold water, but more likely he might want to use them to divert water from his land.
Okay, so just to be clear, a swale is effectively a sort of shallow ditch, isn't it? And you use the contents of the ditch to make a little bank on the downhill side of where the ditch is. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, it could be downhill or it could be uphill.
Okay.
So you can move the soil in either direction. I might be opening myself up to controversy here. Some people say that swales need to be contoured, but to me, you know, I could put a very slight slope, or like make it into a 1 in 300 or 1 in 400 slope, so I can move water along a swale. And if I want it to back up or go into the soil instead of moving off, then all I need to do is put a cross ditch in, and it'll back up along, you know, for tens of meters from each cross ditch. So I don't like to think of a swale as just one thing for one use, but it's got multiple facets to it, and it can be used in many ways. For example, you can put the soil on the bottom side or on the top side. Now, in Nepal, what we do is that we put it on the top side, and so what you end up with is a berm, which then, if that slowly fills with silt or something, it becomes a level terrace, with a terrace edge, you know, on the bottom side that leads down into the swale. So in that way, it's adaptable as well. Yeah, don't get fixed that it's a one thing, but to me it's an adaptable and flexible structure. Could be level. It could have a very slight contour, a slight slope on it. Yeah,
very good. Yeah, that's opened my mind to swales a bit more. I think we're probably coming up to going for a quick music break so that we can have a bit of relief and go and get ourselves some more water or whatever. But before we do that, Eddie Bull's put a question in the chat box. He's put, so what did Chris eat from his garden today? Just so I know he's for real and not just another theorist.
Well, I've had some salad. That's an easy one. Some rocket and some lettuce, some wild garlic, and also some tomato chutney, which wasn't from the garden now, but from last year. So I preserved, just made some chutney to preserve it.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, oh, I love a good chutney. You can make almost anything into chutney as well, can't you?
Yeah.
We've had salad all winter out of the polytunnel here, and we've got a vast amount of broccoli that we're eating. We've just finished the Jerusalem artichokes. I think we're still eating bits of last year's garlic as well, so there's still a bit of stuff going, and now we're getting this year's parsley and all that kind of stuff. I think we're just about to enter the eating season here. So thanks very much for all of the comments so far, Chris. I think people are really enjoying it in the chat box, as far as I can tell. I'm certainly really enjoying it and learning some stuff. I think we'll go to 7 or 8 minutes of music, and then when we come back, perhaps we can talk about your experience of Nepal and how these principles are being applied out there.
Great, sounds good.
Brilliant stuff. So for all of you people out here, here comes Van Halen and Jump. Couple of tracks, about 8 minutes or so, and then Chris and I will be back with you. So here's some Van Halen for you. There you go, Saturday night at the Paradise Knife and Gun Club from Lone Star there. I hope you caught the lyric to that one. I think it's absolutely fabulous. Well, we had a little bit of technical difficulty there, but thanks to Jimmy Hagen's really elegant setup here, it all came back nice and clean. So hopefully you can hear me all out there okay, and hopefully I'm also rejoined again by Chris on the line. You still there, Chris?
I'm right here, yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. Well, that's all looking very good. So having talked a little bit about the about permaculture principles and the kind of stuff you've been doing over here in the UK and the general idea behind it. Perhaps it'd now be really good to talk about the work you've been doing in Nepal along these lines. How long ago did you first go out there? How long have you been working in Nepal?
1985, I went. 28th of February 1985.
30-odd years ago. And was it permaculture that took you out there, or were you out there for other reasons?
No, it was community forestry, actually. I was a volunteer with a charity called VSO, Voluntary Service Overseas, that a lot of people seem to know about. But I applied. I was doing a forestry degree in North Wales, and saw it on the notice board. VSO, you know, work overseas, see the world, that sort of thing. And I'd already known by then that my sort of bent was towards ecology or environment. And that sort of side of life was more attractive than like manufacturing or industry or that sort of thing. And so the thought of going to Nepal to do community forestry was very attractive. So I applied and I got it. And, you know, that was 84. And so by the next year, 85, I was out there doing in a big community forestry project that I was seconded to as a mere volunteer. And it was working in the western Nepal in a very remote district called Jajakot. It was a basic 2-year contract, and it was at the end of that time, actually. I extended for a third year, and it was in that time that I came across the concept of permaculture.
So you actually came across it in Nepal, did you?
Yeah. No, I've not heard of it. It took me a while until I could actually remember the word to be able to ask other people about it. But it turns out that, say, one of the founders, Bill Mollison, had been to Nepal in 86 and had done a course there, and there was a small organization set up as a result. And so I heard about it in, 88 then. And I made contact with them, and, you know, things moved on. And I decided that actually, so the project I was, the VSO forestry project I was working with was actually really, really bad in terms of, it was very corrupt. It was very top down. So all these trees and things we had to plant, or the villagers had to plant, the targets, so the types of trees and the numbers of trees was decided in Rome. And this was because one of the big donors of the project was the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, or FAO, who were based in Rome. So they set all the targets, and they said, these are the species you need to plant. And I mean, in those days, words like sustainability and participation were just not in the dictionary. They weren't used at all. It was only the early 90s when this word sustainability sort of reared its head, and participatory work, it came even maybe a bit later than that, or around about that time anyway. So it was a very unsuccessful project, even though it spent millions of dollars and planted millions of trees. If all of those trees had grown, you wouldn't have space to walk in Nepal now. For those reasons, it was very unsuccessful. So those weren't the only reasons. I mean, yes, it was corrupt. It was top heavy, not participatory. The other thing was it only looked at forestry. I didn't mind that. I was a forester. My education had been all around trees, and I also saw from looking at their culture and their society and the subsistence economy of these places was that they're totally reliant on forests for fodder, for timber, for fuel wood, for food like mushrooms, wild food and medicines, for game, for soil erosion control, for water retention, for all sorts of reasons. These subsistence villages are totally reliant on forests. But That's on one hand. On the other hand, forests are places where their cattle get lost or eaten by tigers. It's where there's leeches and there's dark and, you know, and places where you can't grow food. So there's this interesting sort of tension between the value of a forest in sustaining the farm and therefore the culture, because these places, you know, that are subsistence, they rely on the farm to, you know, they farm what they eat, and they grow fiber crops to make cloth and that sort of thing, and it's pretty low input. But there's this tension between the benefits of the forest and the competition of forest with farmland. And so when permaculture came along, this was answered. You know, this tension was released. And the fact is that you can design your land, you can design your farms, so you've got more trees, but it's not competing with the crops. And so you've got all the benefits of the forest on the farm. And then the forest looks after itself. You don't need to go and exploit it, cut it, burn it, or whatever. You don't need to go to the forest, so it can just stay there and be and do all its sort of ecosystem service stuff. Meanwhile, you're planting agroforestry or forest gardens on the farmland without reducing the traditional cropping productivity. You wouldn't be listened to if you went to a farmer and said, stop growing corn or rice or millet or whatever, grow gooseberries and strawberries and, you know, perennials and make a forest garden. You'd be just laughed off the planet. So what they need is their grains, they need starch, carbohydrates, they need fodder for their livestock, they need straw and stuff for the livestock or whatever. So they have all these systems, you know, wonderfully set up, highly productive, very low input, like all just working on local resources. All they need is a little bit of sort of rejigging of elements and systems around, and they need this is what I came to see anyway, that they need ways of strengthening the resources and the skills that they have, not displacing and replacing food crops with cash crops, for example, or that sort of thing. So it was an incredible learning curve within years of coming into contact with permaculture and seeing what it had to offer, where it was coming from, its ethical base, its philosophy, all that sort of thing, and seeing how that is both mirrored in these communities in Nepal, but also useful to them. And so, you know, it became it was an easy thing to do, actually, just to slip into working with permaculture there.
It sounds like a totally amazing situation for a student of forestry to find themselves in. You must have been very excited.
Yeah, I mean, it's, looking back, I mean, you know, there were tough times too. It was pretty basic living. No electric, no roads, no phone, no this, that, and the other. And at the same time, the risk of, you know, I had to have dysentery, I'd have hepatitis, I had typhoid, I had all these different lurgies over many years, not all at once, obviously. So there were elements of it that were tough as well, but, you know, I didn't mind that. To me, the richness of the place was the culture and the friendliness and the diversity of not only culture, but also, you know, plants and landscape and climate was one of the big ones for me. It's just so diverse. You could go at the bottom of the slope, you've got bananas and pineapple and papaya and the like, and then you go up through citrus areas, and at the top you get to walnuts and apples, and this is only sort of 2 or 3 hours walk apart. It's, or climb, maybe not walk so much, but you know, in that short distance you've got all of those, basically from subtropical to temperate climates and therefore food systems. And, you know, one village might have a house in each of those areas. So, you know, they'd have rice down at the bottom and then citrus and corn midway, and then they might have millet and buckwheat and walnuts and apples up at the top. And they just spend their lives, you know, moving from one place to the other, and they're only an hour or so apart. I thought, what a life, you know. It's the way to do it.
Yeah, certainly. Did they still have plenty of trees left, did they? Because I know that some bits of Nepal got fairly seriously denuded because they were so reliant on the trees, didn't they?
Yeah, it's quite a local thing. What I haven't found, certainly not in hill and mountain Nepal, is a lot of degradation as a result of, you know, sort of multinational corporations coming in and doing large-scale logging like you have in the Amazon and the like. But there is a lot of local pressure, and this was one of the things that I saw, is that people don't seem or didn't seem to have a culture of replanting what they cut down. And I think what this was that in the 60s, I think it was, 60s or late 60s, early 70s, the government nationalised the forest throughout Nepal. And what would have been owned by a community then became owned by the government. So I think that took a lot of the responsibility away from looking after forests. And at the same time, population pressure kicked in. There was a lot more cutting than planting going on, and it became a sort of degrading resource. And where women would have collected fodder, a big load of fodder, maybe 40, 50 kilos of fodder they'd go and collect for the livestock, that job might have taken 20 minutes or half an hour. Then it was taking 40 minutes. Then it was taking an hour. And in some of these areas nowadays, it might take all day to go and come back from the forest with a load of fodder or firewood or whatever. And this was what a sort of spiral of erosion that I was seeing, was that the more forest they cut, the longer it takes to get the same resources that they need anyway. And therefore the less labor there was for it, so the less forest products they could bring, and so therefore, you know, less fodder, less fertility, and so the productivity of each unit of land was going down, but they were cutting more forest and the number of acres was going up. And when you look at that, then you say, okay, well, that is going to perpetuate itself. It's going to get worse, in fact, because the forest gets further away, less resource, less fertility, less crops, clear more land, try and grow more crops, and that cycle goes on. And I saw permaculture as something that was able to cut that spiral of degradation and turn it around into a spiral of abundance, whereby, you know, you have more trees on the land, more fertility, therefore better crops, and more diversification, and therefore you do more stuff. That you have less land, in fact, to grow more, and you know, it just keeps getting more fertile, more diversity, etc. So permaculture was to me a key tool to reverse that degradation into abundance making.
And I guess looking at it from the situation that it was in when you first got there, you do actually get to see the thing changing to the advantage of the people, get to see more food being produced. Do they have ways of storing food? Do they manage to feed themselves kind of all the year round?
Well, we always prioritise the more marginal areas. So again, within a village, you might have some households that have 12 months food supply. There might be some that have six. There might be some that have three. So every village will have a sort of different strata of wealth, if you like. And, you know, some villages will be overall more wealthy than other villages. And we always we had a policy of, or we have a policy now as well, of focusing on the most marginal, communities. So that works at the district level. It works at the village level, and it works at the household level within a village as well, is that we'll always pick out the poorest, because they're the guys that need it most.
And where had Bill Mollison started with his 1986 course? What did you discover that he'd done whilst he was over there?
Very little, actually. I mean, it was only a couple of years later that I came across it. So in that time, what he'd done was inspire a few local people, a few Nepalis, a few local people to set up an organization. and start a farm down on the Terai, somewhere near Chitwan, which is around about central Nepal in the south near the Indian border. And so that became a sort of training and demonstration center, which is where I went to meet the people that were, you know, working there and in the organization. And there were still some permaculture courses being done. So I think in 1988 or 80, was it 87 or 88, that another student of Bill's, a woman called Lee Harrison, she then came to Nepal a couple of three times to do more design courses. And I actually then got to go and help her teach or support, be a support teacher on that. And that was my first foray into teaching permaculture as well. I'd only been, you know, doing it for a couple of years, but felt that, well, I had something to report on that, I suppose. And yeah, it was just great fun. So that was then the process. And what we did was in the district where I was living, in Jajakot, where I'd been a forester, I got a loan off my dad and a small grant from Oxfam through VSO to buy the farmhouse and half an acre of land. And that's where we started our journey, I suppose. That was 1988. And by 1998, when I left that project, well, the Maoist civil war was going on. I wasn't actually allowed into the district. The project was working in 63 communities. We had about 120 staff, part-time and volunteers. We were working in four districts, and we had there was a farmers membership of 12,000 farmers. So we'd got, you know, in that 10, 11 years, we'd gone from zero, from a standing start up to being, you know, a very successful project. And to do all that, you know, four districts, 63 villages, 120 staff, 12,000 members, we had a budget that's the equivalent cost of a Land Rover back here.
Really? Really? So, 12,000 farmers and running it on the price of a Land Rover, and you must have been turning out shed loads of food.
Yeah. Lots of trees planted, lots of festivals, feasts, lots of training courses, lots of stuff grown. Yeah, I mean, we had rabbit, we had Angora rabbits, we had fruit trees, we had, you name it, it was all going on. We had 11 years of you know, continuous development and learning. And, but so cheap. And it was all because, you know, we were using local resources. We didn't have a UK office or even a Kathmandu office. We had no overheads. It was all project, basically.
Very good. So basically the thing must have been literally, in the proper sense of the word, self-sustaining. If you had practically no money to run it on, but you were getting sort of 12,000 people to cooperate with each other, it must have been the permaculture project itself that was kind of managing to make it all happen.
Yeah, I mean, using the principles of design applied to the project as opposed to applied to a piece of land. So this is where I was saying that, you know, permaculture is actually something you can apply to more than gardening. So we were actually using the same principles for the design of the organization and the project that we were working with. And and also we were making a lot of mistakes. It wasn't all hunky-dory, you know, but we were learning from all of that, and it always made the next stage, the next village, easier. So one village, like maybe we'd have some problems with the water or with the trees or something, it would mean that, well, we, you know, we were designing to learn as well, and so that would make it easier for the next village and the next village. And then we clocked onto the fact that actually farmers were the best people to be teaching other farmers. And so we started on that as a concept and started sort of breeding or producing what we now call Barefoot Consultants, who are the farmers that are responsible then for teaching other farmers, other communities. And you know, we developed that concept in the 90s, and we're still using it now because it works. Actually, it's very successful.
I guess that means that you can spread a lot more quickly. What do you think were the most useful mistakes you made in those early years, as a matter of interest?
What were the most useful ones?
Difficult question.
Yeah, difficult. Well, I mean, that was definitely one to allow farmers to do the teaching. Not that it was a mistake to teach ourselves or myself. I mean, I started off farming basically after I'd got into permaculture and we got the farm and then we got another farm. I was farming. I was ploughing. I was getting the fodder, getting the firewood with my local partners. And, you know, I had to learn myself about the farming. I'd gone in as a forester and as a social worker, and I had to learn about farming. And so, you know, I did that, and I planted rice and did all that stuff. And then went over to the teaching side of it, started teaching, and then realized that, it was more of a natural progression, I suppose, that the staff, the farmers, they were the ones that could do the teaching. And each time I was stepping back a level from the actual farming to the teaching and then beyond the teaching to teacher training. Now they're doing even teacher training themselves, and so my job is you know, more networking, fundraising, sort of monitoring and evaluation work. So making sure that they're doing okay and making tweaks where necessary, and then being supportive basically. So that was all to get me off the thought of having to think of mistakes I made. What else was there? Don't walk in long grass in the monsoon. because it come out covered in leeches.
Yeah.
Or when you do walk in the long grass, make sure you've got some anti-leech herbs to carry with you.
Yeah. And how was communication managed in those early years? Because like you say, we had none of the technology, you had no roads. I suppose all of that has probably changed now, has it?
Yeah, that's one of the big things that has changed. Many things haven't changed, but communications definitely have. I mean, in those days, so in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, if I wanted to phone home, phone back to the UK, I'd have to walk for 3 hours, get on a plane, fly for an hour and a half on a little twin otter, get to Kathmandu, cycle down to the telegraph office, usually at midnight because of the time difference, and I could phone home. Now I can be in the same district with a mobile phone and do the same thing. So that has really changed things, actually, communication. I mean, now I can phone my mates in Nepal from here, where I'm sitting talking to you. I could be sitting talking to them in Nepal, and vice versa. When I'm in Nepal, in you know, almost the remotest area, there's still some areas where you can't get a signal because there's no towers. But otherwise, most of the country, you can get reception. And once you get reception, I can phone home, and I have done with my little, you know, little cheap mobile. Pay-as-you-go, whatever.
Yeah, it's amazing how it's stretched out over the world, isn't it? So what kind of techniques are being practiced over there now that weren't being done in the early years? What sort of things have really taken a hold amongst these farmers?
Different things. I mean, so the permaculture approach is, there's a system called zonation. And basically that goes from zone zero, which is the house, inside of which is your fire and, you know, your cooking stuff and sleeping and that sort of thing. And you've got zone one, which is outside, things that you go to regularly. So like a nursery or a salad garden or that sort of thing. And then zone two, and each zone, as zones go out, that you go to them less. So you go from your sort of intensive systems to less intensive systems to livestock systems or field systems, and then woodland systems, and then wilderness is out there, sort of zone five, we call it. And so there's lots of different techniques for each different zone. Just to pick on some of the most popular ones, inside the house, zone zero, the smokeless stove has been incredibly popular. And what it's resulted in is, you know, getting the smoke out of kitchens. So huge amount of illness caused by smoke inhalation for wood-fired cooking.
Yeah.
But not good ventilation in houses because they don't have glass, they don't have insulation, so they keep the doors and windows closed when it's cold, and therefore the smoke can't get out. And that smoke affects in particular the kids and the elderly and the women because they're actually doing most of the cooking. So, big health problems from smoke, eyes, lungs, the whole lot, you know.
So how did the fuel burning change to bring that about?
Very, very simply. It's a very simple design. It's all made from local mud. But using it, they can, you know, get rid of the smoke. So it builds a chimney, and then an enclosed, firebox as opposed to the traditional way on a tripod. So that's how they'd always used to do it. And we've got in one area, we've got 100% now. Of the homes, so every home has got now an improved stove, or what we call an improved or a smokeless stove. And so not only do they take the smoke out and positively affect the health side, but they also use less fuel wood. So it's a double whammy, if you like, of less fuel used, better health. That's the sort of system we like. So, you know, multiple outputs from a single function, from a single system, is exactly what we want, and especially one that's cheap or free to build from local resources. So the stove was very, very popular, and going into zone one, I suppose an example is the potato tower, and I did make one of these just yesterday on our land here in Herefordshire. Where you put, because it's potato planting season down here, you put basically potatoes, 4 or 5 potatoes in a square meter on top of some good compost on the ground, and then I've mulched it with the nettle I was talking about earlier, and a bit of comfrey, just so it's covered, and that will sprout, so I've not dug, but the potato will sprout, and as it sprouts, I'm going to keep mulching it and build it up. And it gets higher and higher and higher until it's about a meter tall or 3 feet tall. You've got this. And then at the same time, I've put corners and, I will weave, other twigs and things around the side. So the mulch doesn't slip off the side, encases it. And basically what I'll end up with is a cubic meter of potatoes.
Oh, wicked. So you're growing potatoes actually in the nettle mulch and other things that you basically harvest over the year. There's no soil.
There's no soil, no. I mean, I might, in Nepal, what they do, because every day they'll sweep out the houses, and these houses have all clay plaster and the like. So there's a lot of dust and detritus goes into that, what we call the sweepings, and they sweep that out. They normally just sweep it away and it blows away in the wind. But what we taught them or showed them is to just collect it in this pile, in this frame, bamboo frame, and plant potatoes in the bottom. And as you know, daily it's increased. And ultimately what they get, I think the record was about 10 kilos of potatoes in a square meter of land, but a meter high. So a cubic meter, if you like, of waste. What was a waste? And what they've got, they've grown potatoes in it. So again, that's indicative of the sort of systems that we really like. They're free or very cheap. They're very low input, but they increase output. Especially, you know, produce a resource. After the potatoes come out, you've actually got a load of well-rotted compost left.
Right. And they make use of waste of what would otherwise be waste as well.
Exactly. I mean, if we'd have gone to the farmer and said, give us some of your manure, because we want to grow potatoes, they'd say bugger off, we need that to grow our rice.
Yeah.
So instead we've made a waste resource into that fertility and produce the potatoes from it. So, you know, that's kind of a systematic of the way we work.
Yeah. Jimmy's put a question in the chat box. He's put, are potato towers not a source for infection? And if an infection occurs, are you not risking huge losses? He says he tried it once and suffered big time. Surprises me that, does it? You had any trouble with that sort of thing using this technique?
infection in what, in the potatoes?
That's just what I've asked. I put, what infection did you have, Jimmy? We'll get an answer to that shortly. It sounds like it ought to be pretty clean of stuff like that, really, if you're just using greens and the like.
Not had many problems with disease, certainly.
And presumably as the potato, I mean, you don't want it to be a hot compost heap, do you? So you'll be putting stuff on in fairly thin layers.
Yeah, fairly thin layers, just enough to cover the shoots as they sprout up. So you're sort of following the shoots, they're leading the way. And of course, each time a shoot comes out from the node, when it's covered, it'll become a root, and the root will then, form a tuber. So you'll get potatoes growing throughout the tower.
I'm going to try that. We've got a few potatoes left over that we didn't manage to plant. I was wondering what to do with those. I'll find somewhere to do this. Jimmy says he got wireworm.
Right. Well, I mean, you can get that in the soil as well. So wireworm, having a potato down doesn't necessarily cause nor solve a wireworm problem. That might be some other reason. I mean, if you put it in the wrong place where it's too shady, doesn't get enough sunlight, doesn't get enough air movement, you might get blight and say, oh, it's the potato tower that's done it. Well, maybe it's just because you put it in the wrong place. Or maybe you kept it too wet. You just need to, this thing about observe what's happening to it. Is it too dry, too wet, too windy, too shady? As a concept, I'm not saying it's going to work perfectly for everybody.
Quite right. The thing
to do is try it and see.
By the same token, though, just because something doesn't work once doesn't mean to say it won't work next time you try it. I mean, by and large, I find that every year there's something that gives you unexpected troubles that you've maybe never had before, and other things that work really well that you've never managed to do before. It's just a question of keeping on trying, isn't it?
Keeping on trying and trying to learn from it. I mean, trying to understand why it didn't work maybe you can't always manage that, because nature is very complex. When you have to take in like day length temperature, soil temperature, air temperature, and species interactions, all that thing, it does get very complex. And we're pretty simple actually compared with the complexity of natural systems. So it takes a lot of observation and experience and sharing experience to fully understand, what's happened and why it's happened. And maybe we never will.
I suppose you'd have to look into what wireworm are and what they like, and find out what you did that the wireworm particularly liked, and what you might be able to do to kind of... he says, he does say, don't get me wrong, Doctor, he's had loads of spuds from the technique, but suffered loads of losses too. I guess it's a matter of trying to play around with what the difference is between those two situations, isn't it?
Yeah. And again, I mean, I'm not a potato expert. But I'm sure there are potato nerds out there that will know exactly what the problem was. I can't put my finger on it. I lay a bet that there'll be people you can ask, that will know, why you got wireworms in your potatoes. I mean, maybe it was too moist, or maybe there was too much air, or maybe there was not the right wireworm predators around. Maybe the variety of potato was more wireworm susceptible. There's so many possibilities that it might have been. It's a challenge to work it out, but it's a positive challenge. It's like, let's get to the bottom of this and find out what that was, and then next time something else will come along. It might not be wireworms, it might be blight. And there's always something to keep us on our toes,
Ultimately, pest control is one of the most lively challenges, I think, of growing food. So it's something I really enjoy, I must admit, is finding decent solutions to keeping the pests at bay. I mean, it's everything right the way down from the deer and the rabbits that you were mentioning earlier, right the way down to greenfly and woolly aphids, and there's a myriad of things that can get at your crop. But learning about that is part of learning about how to get the crop that you need.
Yeah, I think you know, the dealing with pests is a key thing. I mean, when I'm talking with farms out in Nepal and you know, saying, well, what do you want to, how do you want to improve, or what do you want to do, and say, I want to get rid of this pest, or I want to get rid of, you know, snails, or the birds are eating my crops, or we get blight in the potatoes, and that's what they really want to know the solutions for, as a you know, priority. And I think it's pretty similar over here. I think actually, you know, farmers and growers, gardeners are pretty similar the world over. They want to know what's going to harm what they're doing. And they want to know how to maintain fertility. You know, they want to know how to manage their constraints, basically, to remove them and grow better. And I think that's common to humankind, really.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. And there's always new challenges arising. I think ultimately the best, it seems to me that a lot of the best controls to do with pests that I'm coming across are barrier controls of one way or another, fleece to keep the smaller ones out, and rabbit fencing to keep the rabbits out, and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. Is that what you have to do over there? Is it sort of more or less that kind of stuff?
Well, I was just thinking, although what I just said was that those patterns are similar for, you know, humankind about how to protect our resources of crops. What's different there is that they have to do that with local resources and what's there, instead of going to the shops and buying, you know, slug pellets or fleece or bird netting or any of the things that we use for pest control, organic or otherwise. They don't have over there. They don't have access to it, and so they have to be more resourceful and use local resources. For example, garlic, ginger. What are some of the other ones? I'm trying to think of the names now. Marigold, nettles. They'll use things like you know, really sort of smelly, herby, aromatics. The word aromatic plants. And so they'll make teas and tinctures and juices out of those and use those to spray or mulch. And, you know, they'll be more innovative with local resources instead of, yeah, because they can't just go to the shops and buy you know, DDT or whatever it is.
Yeah.
That's available.
So what sort of techniques do they use for keeping rabbits out? As this major problem we've got here. We've got millions of rabbits here. Stunning amount of rabbits.
They eat them.
They eat them.
They don't get a chance to proliferate rabbits. They get eaten quick.
Oh, that's really good. Yeah, yes, I like that.
More of a problem there. They don't even have much of a slug problem. You know, it's like heaven. But what they do have is they have a lot of blight and sort of fungal diseases. A lot of bird preying. They have monkeys. Monkeys will steal corn and that sort of thing. Porcupines. They have, not so much aphids problems either, a little bit. So different problems. I mean, if I could garden in a place that didn't have slugs, man, I would make such abundance. Here it's, you know, okay, this program could get diverted into how we deal with slugs.
And I think there's certainly room for a 3-hour radio show on thousands of different ways of dealing with slugs, none of which actually seem to work particularly well, even when you use 30 or 40 of them together.
Yeah. Oh, no, I lived in Wales for a number of years, in upland wet Wales like yourself, and I got very familiar with slugs up there, so... We are trying to keep on top of them here.
What would you say are your top three? We won't get diverted entirely, but what are your top three ways of dealing with slugs?
I think there might have to be more than three. Beer traps.
Yeah.
Planks that they'll go under in the daytime.
I think planks are great. Yeah, I like that. That's a good solution. You turn it over in the morning, scrape all the slugs off and feed them to the chickens.
Yeah, and ducks, of course. I haven't got ducks yet. We've got plans for ducks, but ducks are probably the most effective slug control. But you've also got frogs. I mean, we've got ponds for frogs, slow worms, So lots of preventative measures. I totally had it full of going out in nighttime and picking them. I did that for years, and I decided I'm not going to do that again. I'm just going to use all the other methods, but not going out and picking them.
It's a bit like there's a kind of carpet of slugs that's moving slowly but surely over the entire planet, and all you're doing is making room for the lot that are coming tomorrow night. I never found that very successful myself.
So no, but they don't have in Nepal. They have a few snails in some places that have caused a problem, but not slugs.
Well, that does sound like luxury. Mind you, it does sound like they've got plenty of other things to deal with. I think the monkeys must be a fairly major challenge. Being pretty bright and inventive creatures. Well, what I'm going to do...
When you've got fields that are sort of out of sight of the house, down the hill or up the hill or around the corner or something, then you know, it's easy for them to take your eye off your field for half a day and your crop's gone.
Yes, I mean, ultimately, being able to keep an eye on what's going on and things like that, I think is really important. I realised when I first came across glass houses and polytunnels that actual regular visits by a human being and trying to deal with whatever problem was presenting itself when it had just arrived, you know, because some of these things, if you leave it even for two or three or four days, something that was a small problem has become pretty uncontrollable, whereas a lot of them can be dealt with by a human being with a regular visit and actually taking action when you find something going on.
Right, yeah.
I thought what I'll do is I'll put in the, I'm just going to put the link into the chat box for those photographs we were talking about earlier. If you could go, folks, to Chris's website, which is HimalayanPermaculture.com. I've put the link in the chat box, but I'll say it for people who are listening outside the chat box. HimalayanPermaculture.com. That'll take you to the front page, and up on the top left of the page is a section called Reports, in which there are, amongst many other interesting things, there are some photographs available, and the ones I thought we might have a quick look. The ones I thought we might have a quick look at. I'm getting strange buzzing noises in my ears. Are called. Hang on a moment, let me just... Here we go. It's called Circuit April 2015, because these pictures give a fair idea not only of the variety of stuff that Chris is doing, but the amazing amount of stuff that's being turned out up there. Are you still there, Chris?
Yeah, I'm here.
Jolly good. Have you got the pictures up in front of you?
No, I haven't, but I took them. So,
right. The first ones of... It says it's one of dozens of the permaculture centre's demonstration farmers in Circuit, and it's a chap with a fantastic crop of cabbages. Because I always think of Nepal as being a really dry and perhaps difficult place to grow things, and this looks like a fairly shady spot for the cabbages. Do you grow a lot of brassicas out there?
Yeah, and I mean because it's altitude. And because of the altitude and the aspect and the latitude, the sun's good and strong, and a lot of plants actually grow much better in light shade than in full sun.
Yeah.
So that's good.
Yeah. And it says you're using companion plants such as fennel and coriander, which means you're getting more stuff out of the ground than just your one major food crop.
Mm-hmm. That's important. That's diversity.
And what sort of growing season do you have there? How long is it? Can you grow all the year round, or is there what we'd call a hungry gap here when you can't grow anything at all? What's it like?
There's both. I mean, because I mentioned earlier how diverse it is. Then you've got there are some areas that are totally frost free all the year round. There are some areas where you know you've got snow for 5 months, and you know all the variations in between. So short growing season might be 3 months, long growth season might be all year round. So we work in all of those places.
And do the farmers across those areas actually cooperate with each other so that the benefits of, say, the longer growing season can be felt by the people who get practically no growing season? Is there a lot of cooperation?
Often, yeah, not always, but often, what you tend to see is the villages at the much higher altitudes have more livestock, so they do more grazing, and so they will trade those with the farmers from the lower altitudes that might have less livestock, and but have more grains. So that form of cooperation is common. And it might be that actually it's the same village anyway, but they've just got houses in different at different altitudes, and you know they'll do the what you call transhumance, so they'll move livestock up and down the hill depending on the temperature on the season, basically. But yeah, I mean there's a lot of trade, a lot of local trade and exchange. Money isn't a currency. So much in a lot of these places, they're called subsistence economies. And so they are trading. They're trading their skills. They're trading their farm products, their livestock, all that sort of thing. So yeah, there's a lot of exchange and trade.
Oh, right. So, there's quite a lot of barter and swapping of skills and stuff for things that other people can grow or obtain. Again, yeah. I guess that leads to, I would have thought that leads to a better sense of community than just being able to hand over some cash.
Definitely. And there's, you know, it's what we call real wealth instead of just monetary wealth. So, I mean, it's interesting, you know, Nepal is called, poor, in terms of its GNP. It is poor. It doesn't have much GNP compared with, you know, this country. But on the other hand, you know, a farmer or a household that might have, in the year, they might turn over, I don't know, a few hundred quid. That might be their, you know, what goes through the household. So, you know, that's, you don't even get that on the dole here. But on the other hand, they might have two houses. They might have, you know, 10 buffaloes, 30 goats. You know, half an acre of land, and all their family. They might have their parents, grandparents, children, grandchildren. You know, they've got childcare, they've got you name it in the village of social links as well. How can we call them poor, you know, compared with us? It's like, it's crazy.
Yes. Yeah, indeed. So much richness in another form. I've just realised that I've actually opened up the wrong pictures. But the next one in that particular set is of a bunch of men holding grafted peach, apricot, and pear seedlings, which they get to take home at the end of a bit of residential farmers training. So they've learnt skills and they get something they can plant when they get home. Do they grow well that kind of fruit over there?
Yeah, again, it's the diversity. I mean, peaches, plums, apricots, apples, pears, walnuts, you name it. They've got both improved varieties, but importantly, they've also got the wild varieties as well, which is really important from the biodiversity side. And it means that we can use those wild varieties as rootstock. So we graft, you know, graft the improved apple onto the wild apple and the improved peach onto the wild peach, and the same with the apricot and all of those. And some villages higher up were better for some and some lower down are better for others. So, but even they might only be an hour or two's walk apart. So, you know, incredible diversity and it all works in their favor. So we've done a lot of work with fruit from the very early days. We've worked with grafting and fruit production because it's from trees. So low input crop, and multifunctional. So as well as getting the fruit, you've got the bees, you know, for pollination. And that again typifies the sort of systems we work with, diverse and low input. And, it's been, you know, the thought that you can actually graft, you can be a surgeon basically, and you can graft one branch onto another root and then it will grow, is a great turn on for farmers that, you know, are just waiting for something to improve their, that they can use to improve their farming. And here's something, they can become a surgeon, just, you know, with local, using local resources. And it's a real mind opener, which then leads on to other things.
Yeah, do you find that they can take these techniques and adapt them to new things themselves? Do you find yourself learning from them when you've given them these techniques? Do they sometimes come back with new stuff that hadn't occurred to you?
Definitely. And if they don't do that, usually they won't keep the technique. So to me, that's a sign that a new technique has been understood and embedded. So it's there, i.e. it's there to stay, is if they change it. If they don't change it and it just kind of becomes stagnant in a way, then it will like go away, rot away in that parallel. But if they change it and modify it to their own situation, season and use or whatever, then you know that that's going to stay, and it's going to stay long after you've gone.
And that's seriously enriching a culture, isn't it, really, doing that sort of thing? And it must be great for you as well, because it means that you're always learning from the people that you're teaching, which strikes me as being a wholly beneficial cycle.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and it's when you realise that, but then the farmers can teach other farms how to do it, and I can step back, or the external or the foreign person can step back and just let them get on with it.
So I guess you're probably having to spend a lot less time there now, are you?
Yeah, not necessarily through my own choice. I would spend more time there if I could, but I suppose what I see is that I can spend less time there and still the work goes on. It's not reliant on me being there. I just like to go there and hang out. Why yeah. not?
So you get a bit more time to work on your own place. I mean, another thing I've pulled up the wrong photographs. I found a really nice set of them, which I can't, whilst we're kind of live online, I can't actually seek out. But one of the things I remember seeing is that you were running kind of healthcare classes and that kind of stuff as well. What was going on with those largely?
Yeah, I mean, it's like I say, it's not all about growing food. Society is complex. And one thing that unites us all is that we need to eat. But there's a range of other issues as well. So we work not only with food security and food skills, but also with health, and in particular women's health, because they tend to be the ones that are suffering the most from health problems. They do the most work, have the most workload. And so we look, I mean, the stove stuff is connected with that, you know, because that's going to improve their health as well. But preventative health, so women being able to diagnose themselves, to use local herbs to treat themselves, to be able to receive counselling. And that sort of thing. So we have projects or a big part of the project is to work with that. Then as well as health, you've got education. So we work with schools, distributing handbooks, farmers' handbooks and other materials, but also running vocational classes with kids and designing school land to be more productive. And then we also work with livelihoods, so actual income, looking at income generation or resource production. So things like growing nettles for producing into fibre that you can then weave into cloth, etc. And we're looking at herbs processing for medicinal purposes. Beekeeping, we do a lot of beekeeping for honey production, wax. And obviously the fruit and stuff, you know, when it's in excess, then it's something that can be sold. So we are looking at income generating projects as well. But the focus, I suppose, is on, you know, food and health. Because if you haven't got those two things, then, you know, no matter what opportunities or markets there are for making something you can sell, you can't use them because you're poorly or you're starving. Yeah. So you know, we've always got the foci.
And how are the bee populations surviving over here? Because I know beekeepers are having a real problem here. What's it like in Nepal?
Yeah, it's a problem there too. Really, we've been seeing we can't understand it so much because there's not so many chemicals used, or pesticides, herbicides used in the villages where we are. They're too remote. But still, the bee population is quite erratic, and we're not totally sure why it is. It's not intensive beekeeping like it is over here with it, and where they're moving bees around and all the things that cause stress to bees. There's not so much environmental stress going on. But still, yeah, it's a problem. But we're trying to understand just what's going on.
I had heard the actual mobile phone systems and stuff, the kind of electromagnetic radiation is causing them a lot of confusion. Had you heard that?
Could be, yeah. I'd heard a murmur of that. It could be. That could be one of it. I think with bees, it can be a lot of different things combined or apart. They're pretty sensitive creatures. So we have put a lot of focus on that, actually, not just because it's a good income generator for the farmers, but that it's, very important for the environment and for the bees themselves. The more bees, the better.
Yes. What about the herbs and things for health? Because, in times gone by, our population had a much wider knowledge of the kind of herbs that were useful for keeping people well and healthy. Is that kind of knowledge still widespread there? Are people discovering new things? Is there a fairly useful pharmacopoeia available out in the countryside?
Very much. Yeah, very much. I mean, traditionally there will be certain individuals in the village that will have the responsibility of holding that knowledge. So the healers, basically, or they might be shamans or they might not be shamans. But yes, that knowledge is there. It's much reduced. A lot of it's been lost, or maybe if not lost, not given focus or priority. And we are trying to sort of revitalize that and get people to realize the value of local herbs that they've got and doing cultivation of those herbs and also the processing and the treatment. I mean, it's a whole, it's not just having the plants, it's knowing how to use them, and trying to get that documented as well, trying to get the stories, from the old folk before they're not around anymore. That's an important part of it as well, because if you can keep your health just with your local resources, then you don't need your hospitals, you don't need your drug companies and the like, and that's certainly a good fix to get off.
Yeah. What do you reckon the chances are? I mean, we hear again and again from around the world that the women do most of the work. Do we see any evidence that as a result of all this activity, the men are starting to do more of the work?
If only. I suppose some of the nature of the work is changing slowly. I mean, because of the stoves, again, what we've got is a healthier climate for the women. Because there's less fuel wood involved, then that's reducing a load. Fodder grown at home means less trips to the forest. So a lot of these systems that we've been putting in over the years have resulted in less work for women. That is one of our aims, basically, reducing the inputs, whether it's women or men. I mean, I suppose it happens that a lot of that work would have been done by women anyway, so they actually will be the primary benefactors from doing that. So, yeah, great, more power to them. And it means they can put more time into, maybe earning an income, maybe educating themselves. So we run literacy classes as well to teach people how to read and write. And we have a farmer's handbook. If on the web page that you pointed out, actually, there's one button that says farmer's handbook, and that leads you to an English version that was translated. But the original farmer's handbook was written in Nepali. And that's full of all the different techniques that we use. But the one you'll find on the website there is English, so that's obviously easy, and you can download it for free. And, that's been a real game changer. That was basically a compendium of all the techniques that we used over the first 10 or 12 years. And we use it also, apart from as a technical support, we use it for literacy education as well, because it's quite simple, and lots of pictures, big letters, that sort of thing. And we did that on purpose, not because we're stupid. We did it because it's easy for people to learn to read. And, you know, again, it's something that we take for granted in this country. We can all read. We can see the script on the screens. We can see the books and the papers and everything. But there, in some of the communities, only sort of under 10% of the women can read and write. And so, you know, we teach them. We've got a 9-month course that we take them through using the farmer's handbook. And they learn, you know, Jack and Jill goes up the hill to make a compost heap or something like that. But, you know, the change that you see, if you can imagine, you know, put yourself in the place of someone that cannot read or write, and they're an adult, and then all of a sudden, well, not all of a sudden, over 9 months, they can get so they can read a book, they can read a letter that someone sent to them, they can write a letter to one of their mates, and, you know, just imagine the empowerment that that brings is mind-boggling, actually. And, you know, there we are toying with you know, worms and strawberries and this, that, and the other. But and on the other side, you've got people that all of a sudden they can read and write. And that's, you know, such a huge change.
And the process of learning to read and write has taught them quite a lot about how to grow crops and do medicines, all the things effectively that you've found to be useful over the years.
Yeah, yeah. So that's, you know, it's basically, it's given the farmer's handbook another function, in literacy education. So.
Very good. Well, and has it, you know, it sounds like it's reached an awful lot of people, the work that you started all those years ago. Do you think it's fundamentally made a difference to the countryside and the way it's working? I mean, it sounds like it's that kind of scale of project.
I mean, again, it's in local ways, not as the nation as a whole, I wouldn't say. I mean, that, you know, the nation as a whole is trying to go in a different direction, I suppose, in modernizing and developing in that way. But what we've got is local pockets of skills that have been developed and demonstrations that are on the ground. And this is an interesting concept that we started off in 1988. We said, okay, what we need to do first is demonstrate. So we need to show what needs doing, whether it's a fruit tree or a vegetable or, you know, a beehive or whatever. We need to show it. We can't just teach it on a blackboard, or a book. We need to show it on the ground. So demonstration. Then we need to have training programs that teach people how that demonstration was created and managed, so it can keep going. So you know, you didn't have to keep putting lots of inputs in just at the start, and then it's more self-maintaining. And so that became the second part of the program, was the training. So first was the demonstration, then was the training, and the third part then was, okay, so a farmer has come and they've seen a lovely apple tree, and they've learned how that apple tree was produced, propagated by grafting. Now they need an apple tree to take home and plant, and then they can continue it themselves. So the resource production. So that became the third part of the strategy. We developed this back in 1988, and we're still using that same strategy now. And not only that, but in the UK, permaculture in the UK also looked at that strategy, a dozen years ago, and thought, okay, we need a strategy like that as well. And they developed what's called the LAND project, learning and demonstration project, that got lottery funding. And as a result, the Permaculture Association in the UK has now set up, I think it's going on for 100 different sites around the UK, or mainly in England. Now it started in England, in Scotland and Wales as well, where you can go and see demonstrations and receive training and access resources to, you know, continue permaculture development on your own land with another community. So it's really interesting how that strategy that started in Nepal in 1988 sort of spread to the UK in whenever it was. It might have been about 2003 or 4 or something, 5, but it started in the UK as well. And that it's actually not development isn't a one-way thing from so-called wealthy to so-called poor nations. It can actually go the other way. And you know, the Nepalis have got an awful lot that they can teach us in terms of how we manage our resources and our society, for that matter.
And it sounds to me like you got to them before they'd actually lost all of their traditional farming techniques, and they have more or less disappeared in this country now. It also strikes me that this is that the techniques, the approach that you're talking about here, is actually building a strong foundation, which is actually designed to be able to support itself and expand itself and help people move forwards. Is it being successful in the UK? Are you seeing more people coming forward for permaculture training?
Definitely. The association it's based in Leeds. And they're doing a great job, actually. I haven't travelled around much over the last few years, but in the first, between sort of 88 and 2000 or so, I did a lot of travelling internationally as well, going around learning and networking with other groups. And I'd always come back and think how well together the UK Permaculture Association is, and that has maintained that characteristic. And it is one of the most best organized, proactive, national organizations or umbrella permaculture organizations that I've seen. So they're doing a great job. And, also because, we've just got some new land, down here in Herefordshire.
Yeah, where are you in Herefordshire?
We're, at the north end of the Golden Valley. We've just got a 10-acre couple of fields there that we bought, and I mean, it's something I've wanted to do for decades. I've spent my life in Nepal, I suppose, building or teaching how to build and overseeing the development of these resource centres for demonstration and training, and always thinking, oh, I'd like to do this in Britain as well. And finally, you know, after, you know, 30 years of self-learning, I suppose, self-education, we've actually got it together to get some land, and we're starting to do it here. So we've got course programs planned for the summer. And, it's a lovely place. It's called Applewood, and it's at the north end of the Golden Valley. So it's about 10 miles, 12 miles from Hereford, 6 miles from Hay-on-Wye, 6 miles from the Welsh border.
Oh, you're not very far away from us. We'll have to come over and see you. How long have you been there?
Only just. We've been watching it for a year. So we first saw it in April last year and decided that that was the land for us. And so we have been watching it for a year. More recently, we've been starting to get a bit more proactive. And I've started a fruit nursery, and we've been managing a vegetable garden. Now we're looking to get training resources. So we're going to get a shepherd's hut made into a kitchen and shower unit, and put a marquee up there for training in, and hopefully run some courses this summer.
Very good. And this is your designedvisions.co.uk website, is it? For more information on that, I'll just post that into the chat box. It sounds like it'd be great to come over and see it kind of in its early stages. Actually, and it must be very exciting for you with all of this experience to see how it's going to manifest itself on the ground. Are you going to be doing all the work yourself, or are you planning on having the people who come on the courses help you out, or are you going to have volunteers, or how are you going to manifest it?
Yeah, all of that. I mean, it's great to, you know, get stuck in yourself, many hands make light work. You know that one.
Yes.
Just yesterday we had every Wednesday we have what's called a Working Wednesday. We want to focus on local participation. I mean, you know, we've got both me and my partner Luby, we've done courses, all over the world, you know, for, umpteen years. And, but we now want to sort of, focus very much on local community. So we like to get locals around to help out, but we've also got some volunteer weeks, where people can come and camp. You're very welcome to come and visit at some point. If you come on a Wednesday, you'll be given a spade or a trowel or a scythe or something and asked to get on with it. But it's also a lovely place to hang out. It was a lovely day yesterday as well. Today's not been so good.
No, it's been a bit rough out here as well, but hey, we wouldn't be getting anywhere without the variety and the weather.
No, we did need the rain.
Yeah. Well, we don't have a problem with being given a trowel or a scythe or a shovel or whatever. We're always happy to dig in wherever we're going because, as I said earlier, I think you get to know people so much better when you're working with them and work up a bit of an appetite as well. So by going to designedvisions.co.uk, people can find out about your working Wednesdays or your volunteer days. Are you finding the locals willing to get involved? Are you actually attracting them to your honeypot, as it were?
Yeah, slowly. I mean, we're not pushing it. We don't want to be in their faces. You know, we know that relationships like this are long term. So I think ultimately we need to find our own niche. And need to be, you know, supplying with something that they want and that they need, and not assuming that we know best, or because we don't, obviously. You know, we've got a lot to learn about what goes on in the local area as well. But if we can be a service, then you know, that will be our marketing slant, basically. Yeah.
Have you found other people around you with a similar view?
Yeah.
Because that's, I think, is also important, is to develop not only a community, but I think ultimately our strength is going to be in a community of communities.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, those are the first people generally that you'll come across, won't they? They'll be the like-minded people, the people that you can hang out and chat about things and, yeah, gardening nerds and the like.
Well, I mean, it doesn't matter how long you garden for, you're always learning new stuff, partly because it's different everywhere you go, but partly because you're constantly running into people who've tried new things. So if nothing else, that's a good reason for going to see other places like what you're doing, because you are guaranteed by meeting other people to meet new things, to learn new things. It just doesn't stop.
Definitely, yeah. It's an ongoing process till the day I die.
Yes. Farming forever, eh? Farming forever.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's been a really great chat, Chris. Thank you very much. And I'm sure that me and Jess will come over and see you, because you're not very far away. We'll sort of wait for the busy time. It's a particularly busy time of year here, but things do calm down a little in the summer. So come over for one of your working Wednesdays, or look for one of your volunteer weeks, maybe.
One in June, one in July, take your pick. Don't have to come for the whole week, just a day or two, bring your tent. That'd be great.
Very good. Well, that'd be absolutely brilliant. I'd thank you so much for making the time, and thanks for all the work you've done. I think it's really brilliant what you've been doing with your life. Well done, mate.
Thanks a lot. It's been great fun chatting, yeah.
And so if you hang on the line, I'll just put some music on for the folks, and just have a quick word before I let you go. I'm going to put on Dick Gorhan, No Gods and Precious Few Heroes. Well, I think there are still some heroes left. It's just they're keeping it quiet. Here you go. The Stranglers and Duchess, preceded by Eye Monsters, Daydream in Blue, and before that, Dick Gorhan's No Gods and Precious Few Heroes. I only discovered him recently, and my goodness, he's written some good lyrics, but I particularly like that one. We'll be hearing more from him, I'm sure, in future shows. Well, thanks very much to Chris Evans for coming on and talking to us about permaculture. Personally, I'm very impressed by the broad scope of what's going on there, the fact that people are being helped back into traditional ways of medicine, traditional ways of food growing, and not so traditional ways, new ways. I love to hear that people are taking new techniques they're being taught and then adjusting them for their own locale. I love to hear that these barefoot consultants are going out and teaching more people, that the literacy that's being taught is also helping to teach people to grow food, that it's increasing the amount of bartering that can be done amongst these people and these villages. I think it's an all-round good story, and whilst it is important that we try and work our way back to growing enough food to feed ourselves, that is no means, by no means an easy task, and it is by no means all, in my opinion, that we need to do. We need to be learning new skills, we need to be finding out how to employ new technologies, we need to be revivifying our communities, and we need to be reaccessing natural forms of medicine, all the rest of it. All of it, as far as I'm concerned, as important as all of the rest. And it sounds to me like over the last 30 years or so, Chris has done really a pretty amazing job at not only doing the groundwork, but actually making sure that now that he's no longer out there so much, that the groundwork continues. And bloody 10 out of 10 to him, that's what I say.